Hello and welcome to volume 142 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss the problems with how the U.S. Forest Service has designated the protected areas for the black pine snake. We'll discuss ways to deal with your fear of prescribed burning. We'll check in on timber prices. And we'll learn more about the Biden administration's plans called 30 by 30 and how it could affect land use in the United States. This program is brought to you through the generous contribution of Forester Search, a service that makes it easier to connect landowners with consulting foresters. You can access the site through foresterssearch.com, or there's a link on this page, and you'll be given a roster of consulting foresters who can guide you through the next steps you'll face as a forest landowner. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. President Biden signed an executive order number 14008 on January 27th of this year, 7 days after the inauguration, which stated that the U.S. faces a profound crisis and that we have a narrow moment to avoid catastrophic consequences and that our actions must go hand in hand with international leadership and that together we must meet the moment. And of course, he's talking about climate change. Our first guest is Margaret Byfield, Executive Director of American Stewards of Liberty. Welcome, Margaret.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Part of this executive order, 14008, is the 30 by 30 program, which seeks to protect 30% of America's land and oceans by 2030. So under the 30 by 30 program, what types of land protections are being sought by the administration?
Well, right now it's a little fuzzy. They have not revealed a lot of details, but what we have been able to kind of assess is that they, in their materials, they also talk that they consider 12% of the land already to be protected. And the phrase is permanently protected in its natural state. And so what we looked at is what made up that 12%. So what do they consider qualifies for that permanent protection, and they name wilderness areas, national parks, national wildlife refuges, and importantly on private lands with conservation easements, those perpetual conservation easements. So that is what they are looking at right now. I mean, they may include some other things in that number too, but we know that is what they have considered to be protected already under the same measure that they plan to be doing 30 by 30.
Okay. Is the land sought to be protected all federal land, or are they seeking to protect private land through some sort of device of condemnation or otherwise?
Well, I think they're looking at conservation easements, but one thing that they have also done is they rescinded an order in the Trump administration that allowed states and local governments to veto a federal land acquisition in their area if it was to be purchased under the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And, you know, this climate crisis EO was signed January 27th. Department of Interior rescinded that order on February 11th. So it looks to me like they're already clearing hurdles for even just outright condemnation of land and going in and purchasing it, and they're taking away landowners' protections to have at least their local community and the state have a say on yes or no, do we want federal land in our area or not? So I think it can be, we know they're going to be targeting private property because they say that 60% of the land in its natural state is in private property, but only 1% of that is protected. So I think that we have to expect them also targeting private property. And of course, the federal lands are expected to be targeted with wilderness and national parks and some of the other things as well.
Okay. Is there a scientific reason why the program has a good chance of reversing climate change?
No, the science is very fuzzy. And if you read, the executive order doesn't cite any science. Even some of the background information don't cite any science. The Department of Interior memo talks about scientists saying that we need this, but there's no study cited. So, you know, they haven't given a reason for this yet. I really think that what we're dealing with is you just have kind of the outliers of the real extreme kind of climate crisis perspective that are driving this debate. And they're the people that are saying if we don't reverse climate change in the next 9 years, then, you know, the asteroids come into the Earth and we're all going to die. And that's really their perspective. You read the climate crisis EO and you get the sense that if we don't do something drastic now, today, you know, we're on an unending course to annihilation. And that just is not a rational perspective. And you can talk to a lot of scientists, and those that believe in climate crisis or believe in climate change and that believe that climate is, that man does contribute to climate change. And even the majority of them are going to say, but we don't need extreme measures to solve it. So I think this is more of a political agenda rather than a science-based agenda.
Well, you know, if we are on a course for annihilation, it looks like Congress would get involved in some way. This is not an act of Congress. This is an executive order. What authority is the administration pursuing? Under what authority is the administration pursuing this?
Well, in the executive order, they don't cite any authority. And, you know, as you, I'm sure you know, Congress is the one that sets policy, and Congress doesn't have a policy that says we need to protect 30% of our land and take it out of any, you know, private land ownership. Congress hasn't authorized this. The Constitution doesn't authorize it. So right now, this is just a policy that is being pursued without the authority. However, I will say that there are members of Congress that would like to see a 30 by 30 bill or proposal put into something and authorized by Congress. And so we have to be very mindful of that they're serious about this agenda and they will be working to try to get that authority. But currently, they do not have that authority.
Okay. How are ways that people can get involved in learning more about the issue and expressing their view?
Well, one of the things that we believe is very critical is we've developed a local government resolution that local governments can pass. If you can get your local government on board to pass the resolution and show that the people at the ground level oppose this program and get it back into us, we are forwarding that to the key contacts we have in Washington, D.C. that are using these to push back. And get that into us. That's very, very helpful. And then also, you know, sign up for our Liberty Matters news service. It's a free service, and it's a newsletter that we produce, and we are, you know, trying to direct traffic on this best we can to keep people informed on what's going on, and that way if you sign up for that, you can stay connected, and we can keep you informed on other things that you can do. But it's really important. The local government resolutions are good, but also contacting your congressman and your state governments, making sure they know that you oppose it.
Okay, that Liberty Matters news service is a link on the page that we have for you. Well, Margaret, we thank you for that. We appreciate your participating in our discussion today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Our next guest is Scott Jones, CEO of Forest Landowner Association. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Hayes. Glad to be here.
Scott, the longleaf forests of Mississippi and Alabama are not only productive and viable forests, but in some places they're also the habitat for the black pine snake. These places are defined by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as critical habitat. What issue does FLA have about how the Forest Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has defined critical habitat for the snake?
Yeah, Hayes, first of all, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is mandated to designate critical habitat when a species is offered protection under the Endangered Species Act. So we're not contesting that they should be designating critical habitat. But when they do this designation of critical habitat, when they create this, they're also mandated to consider the best available scientific data available to them when designating these areas, and also to consider the potential economic impact of this designation. And in the case of the black pine snake, the Fish and Wildlife Service used a sighting of the black pine snake on one of these critical habitat units that was 20 years old. So in 20 years, no one has had a sighting of the snake on these areas. And also, they assess the economic impact to private forest landowners as $0. So with those two issues alone, and just the simple Fish and Wildlife ignoring the economic impact and using 20-year-old data, we felt like we had to step in and correct this issue.
What difference do you think it makes to a landowner whose land could be defined in this way?
Yeah, so the best way to define this is look at it as an example. All things being equal, if you're looking at two pieces of property for purchase and one has a critical habitat designation and the other one does not, obviously the property that has a critical habitat designation is going to be worth less because it is encumbered. It has impacted that landowner's private property rights and freedom of operation on their property to enjoy their property to the fullest extent. And there's lots of nuances with federal nexuses and participating in federal programs, but it really boils down to that. Two properties being equal, if you're looking at one versus the other, one is certainly encumbered. And if it is encumbered, then the economic impact is not $0. It is a monetary value. So even though U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has said that there is no economic impact, I think just clearly we can look at that example and say there is. So not only has your property rights been impacted, but the monetization of or the value of your property has been impacted as well.
Okay. Well, thank you, Scott. We appreciate that.
Thank you, Ace.
Prescribed fire is a time-honored practice to manage forest stands, but some landowners are reluctant to use the practice. Jennifer Fawcett, an extension associate at North Carolina State University, can explain. Hello, Jen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Prescribed burning is sometimes worrisome to forest landowners. Why is that?
Well, I'd like to start out by saying that in Alabama and actually throughout the Southeast, our ecosystems have evolved with fire. So before there were railroads and highways, there were thousands of acres of contiguous forest land that would burn from a single lightning strike. Now that our land's so fragmented, we can't rely on lightning strikes to burn all the land that needs to be burned. So prescribed burns have to be conducted to play that role in the ecosystem, including on private land. So that being said, burning can sometimes be worrisome for landowners for a lot of different reasons. It often depends on the experience level of the landowner. For those landowners that have never conducted a burn, maybe just knowing where to start or what to expect might be an initial worry. Some landowners may not feel equipped with the experience or knowledge needed on how to conduct a burn safely. There's a lot of considerations that need to be accounted for when planning a burn, one of the biggest being the weather. So the temperature, winds, relative humidity, those all play a really large role in knowing when to conduct a burn, and that knowledge just purely comes with education and experience. Other landowners might be worried about not having enough people to help on the burn or having the proper tools and equipment, but it seems like the biggest worry for landowners when it comes to prescribed burning is liability. What happens if the burn escapes, if there's property damage, if the smoke becomes an issue on the roads or with neighbors? So concern for liability is usually cited as the number one reason why a landowner isn't applying prescribed fire to their property.
If a landowner could get past some of those concerns, what do you think the benefits are to landowners that help balance the equation?
Oh, there's just so many benefits to burning. First, from an economic perspective, prescribed burning is actually the most economic way to manage your land as compared to herbicides or mechanical means. From an ecological perspective, prescribed burning is included in most forest management plans because it's used to meet so many different types of forest management objectives. It can be used for site prep as you're starting out a new timber stand or maybe transitioning from an ag field to a forest. It improves wildlife habitat for both game and non-game species, especially when patches of unburned areas are left for nesting and cover. It reduces competition from hardwood species that can't tolerate fire. It increases biodiversity of plant species, especially in ecosystems like the longleaf pine ecosystem, where the whole ecosystem thrives on fire being on the landscape. And Finally, when conducted frequently, prescribed burning actually minimizes the risk of a devastating wildfire by reducing the amount of leaf litter and pine needles and other fuels on the forest floor. And that one's huge because as our climate becomes drier and hotter, we're going to see an increase in wildfires in the coming decades. And oh, my favorite one, it also reduces the tick population.
Okay, well, that's a good. You've mentioned liability concerns. Are there some ways to protect landowners that choose to conduct private or prescribed burn?
Yes, there are. And landowners should know that based on the studies, the perception of risk is much higher than the actual risk of conducting a burn. So the risk of liability from an escape burn prescribed fire is minimal. It's less than 1%. But, yes, there are a lot of things that landowners can do to protect themselves. So for those landowners who've never had a burn on the property before or don't really have a desire to conduct a burn themselves, they should reach out to a local forestry consultant who can write up the burn plan and conduct the burn for them. The Alabama Forestry Commission can also provide some help. I'd also recommend just getting hands-on experience. In some areas, there's groups of neighbors that get together called prescribed burn associations where community members share their time, their equipment, and their experience with one another. And this is a great way to get some hands-on experience with people who are more experienced in burning. From an educational perspective, there's actually a lot of information out there on prescribed fire. One of them in particular is a online course that we put together on NC State called eFire that is available for free online with lots of short videos and readings about how to plan and conduct and evaluate a burn. But okay. I'd say the most important thing is to understand the local and state laws that address liability. That's essential. So all states across the southern region have laws that actually protect prescribed burners and give people the opportunity to become a certified prescribed burn manager. And that will provide people with a level of liability protection. So I would just encourage people to look up their state laws.
Okay. Well, thanks, Jen. We appreciate that very much.
Great. Thank you.
Mike Powell with Forest Markets is in our markets chair. Welcome, Mike.
Hey. Thanks for having me.
What are the market forces that are driving the lumber prices at the retail end right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with lumber being a highly traded commodity, I mean, market prices for lumber can react to a variety of events throughout any day, some of those being short-lived, some a little longer. With that being said, primarily lumber is basically a product of supply and demand with really two primary influences. Historically, these have been thought of as housing starts or would be what would be the demand and lumber inventory at the mills or would be the supply. So basically, you know, kind of what we saw last year early on in the pandemic with low lumber inventories as mills were expecting a lower than normal demand from the housing market collided with an actually much stronger demand, which was driven by our home improvement and remodel sector. And, you know, the prices just reacted extreme.
Okay. Well, let's move backward in the supply chain to log prices then. What is driving low log prices now?
Yeah, that's a great question and one that, you know, we've been hearing quite a bit lately with lumber being in the news as much as it is. But really not to repeat myself, but, you know, log prices are also primarily a factor of supply and demand, although it's important to note a completely different supply and demand. So the primary factors affecting log prices would be standing timber inventory or available wood to harvest, and then, of course, the demand from consuming mills. So although high lumber prices are good for demand for raw materials, the South is currently faced with a huge oversupply of logs. It's really been building since the Great Recession and continuing to compound due to higher efficiency mills, you know, just keeping the prices in check.
Okay. Well, do you suspect that there might be higher stumpage prices in the future on the horizon?
Yeah. So, I mean, with raw materials or, you know, timber really being one of the largest single input costs for lumber production, you know, common sense, or one would think that the correlation would really be parallel. And they are connected. As I kind of mentioned earlier, you know, healthy markets for outputs typically create higher demand for inputs. So, but you know, what we're faced with right now, at least in the near term, is that adequate supply is keeping the prices in check. However, the good news is the U.S. South does continue to be on the forefront for new lumber production, and we do expect this to continue to march along, with that being the end result being higher sawmill capacity, which will help reduce our current oversupply, and that rise in consumption will flow downstream and could impact prices on the stump.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mike. Well, that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Margaret Byfield, Scott Jones, Jen Fawcett, and Mike Powell. If endangered species liability for prescribed fire and low stumpage prices aren't enough of a buzzkill, just think about what effect large-scale initiatives to deal with climate change could do to you. The first three can be either localized, limited, or waited out. But the fourth is something so large, no one can predict whether the outcome is beneficial or detrimental to forest owners. Do you think forest owners will come out on top when large-scale climate regulations are passed? Will forest owners be paid to reduce carbon in the atmosphere? Will climate change regulation cause your product to be more valuable? Stay tuned, because the next 2 years will very possibly be a tipping point for forest owners and the role they play in society. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.